Food Talk with Mike Colomeco has been brought to you by Cento, Calavita, and Wines of Portugal.
Hi, this is Joe Campanelli, the host of In the Drink. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, folks, welcome. Mike Colomeco here. Mike Colomeco's Food Talk, live from Heritage Radio Network, Bushwick, Brooklyn, the Morgan stop on the L train, the epicenter of hipsterdom. Yeah, well, whatever. I'm too old for that stuff. But I've got some great guests today. I've got two chefs in that fed me some of the best meals I had last year, the end of last year, last fall, where I forayed into Brooklyn, which is something I usually don't do because I live in Manhattan, and I've been in Manhattan forever, so it's sort of like that's my borough. But there's so much going on in Brooklyn, you cannot deny it, nor can you ignore it. Some of it's hit or miss. I won't go into details or specifics, but I talk about the places I like. So I had heard about, I think, my three guests on today. Two chefs who run the restaurant, and Andrew Friedman, who's a great cookbook author, has a great blog. I Googled it today. It was Tocqueville. It's Tocqueland, Michael. Sorry about that. I screwed that up. We'll get to that in a minute. But I think Andrew suggested I try it. I heard great things about it, and I went to Dover and Battersby kind of back-to-back a couple of weeks apart last November, maybe early December, and really had two of the best meals I'd had all year anywhere, period, which is saying a lot because I eat out three nights a week pretty much all year long. That's what I do for a living. So the chefs are with me. Guys, thanks for coming in. Walker, Joe.
Thanks for having us.
No, pleasure. And Andrew's going to chime in. We're going to have three guests for the first half an hour of the show, take a little break at the bottom of the hour, and then Andrew and I are going to talk about what he does with his blog, which is Tocqueland.
Yes.
Which is a great, great site. We'll talk about what it is, what it's about, the nexus, how he approaches it, why it's different than so much of the other stuff out there in the blogosphere world, much of which has to do with who he is and what he brings to the table. And then we'll talk about a couple of projects. If it's not too soon, we could talk about the book you guys are putting, your cookbook? Too soon?
No, not too soon at all.
Okay,
no,
yeah, I love the concept. It's interesting. And then we can talk about what Andrew has something coming up that's great that he's been working on for a long time, a book that kind of needs to be written, and thank God someone's doing it that has his voice. But anyway, let's talk about your restaurant, guys. So before we get into what you're doing at the restaurant, just pick it up. I filmed something with you for PBS, so I'm asking questions I kind of know the answer to now, but we have an audience here that's all over the country, really. Talk about your experience prior to opening, where you worked, where you met, so we can kind of get the narrative going back, say, 5 years before the opening of Dover.
Well, Walker and I first met at culinary school. We both went to the CIA, the Culinary Institute of America, in Hyde Park, New York. And we had a couple of mutual friends, and we met there. And then we kind of, after school, we went on our own separate ways. And then we ended up crossing paths again, working at the Essex House, an Alan Ducasse restaurant.
Which, I'll stop you just for 1 second. I was out with somebody the other night. Who was it? Another chef friend of mine. And everyone, DDA's name came up, DDA Elena. And everybody said that at that time, that restaurant, Celebrities was called, right? Was it Celebrities? What
was no,
the name it was just Alan Ducasse. Whatever it was called.
Yeah.
Whatever was it, that was, everybody says that was the best restaurant in the city at the time and one of the best restaurants in the world at the time.
Yeah, so, it was it
insane
was a,
kitchen.
A great experience working there. I've never worked at a place like that at all, just from, you know, the kitchen and the amount of money that went into it and the products that, like, passed through our hands every day. We just kind of felt fortunate to be there and to have our hands on you know, a project like that. After we were there for a little while, the restaurant ended up closing down because you can't do something like that.
Yeah, there's something called food cost.
Yeah. So, well, it ended up closing for a lot of reasons. But
yeah, it did. It did.
That's one of them. And Walker and I, again, split up and went our own separate ways, but we kind of stayed in touch. And then we moved on to do our own respective projects, eventually taking chef positions at smaller restaurants in Brooklyn. And, you know, still ended up, like, being in touch throughout the months and meeting up for drinks or whatever. And we just started talking about doing a project on our own, you know, after working at these high-end restaurants and then also working at small restaurants in Brooklyn. We realized that opening up a restaurant was a lot more obtainable than it had seemed in our past because of this like new era of dining that you see in Brooklyn. So we just kind of, you know, blindfolded, dove right into it, and we ended up with a little bit of money and a lot of time. We put together a plan to do Battersby, and you know, after a year of trying to pull it together on a shoestring, it actually ended up happening.
And literally a shoestring.
Literally.
Investors, a couple of investors, friends, parents, family, credit cards.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't really know what was going to happen. We put together a business plan, which we didn't really know how to do. Did a lot of like Googling on, you know, how to do this and how to do that. And we raised an extremely modest budget and ended up doing a lot of work that would be, you know, outsourced. We ended up doing it ourselves to get the restaurant open.
Construction-y.
Yeah, you know,
all that stuff.
Construction, right. Design, you know, even like some of the, you know, opening, like purchasing, like a lot of stuff was bought secondhand from other restaurants, or we would go to like auctions and try to find the cheapest stuff.
It's the best way to do it.
Pearl River, the plates.
Let someone else buy that 20-quart Hobart for list price. I'll get it 3 years later for hopefully a good price at the auction if no one other jerk-offs are raising the price up. Yeah, I used to love auctions when I had my restaurant. It was like the place we bought everything every year when we got done. It was how you improve the kitchen, basically. And to describe Battersby, I had actually been, we talked about this, it's kind of ironic because, well, maybe back in 2000, 2001, we filmed in our first or second season with Alan Harding at Patois, and I remember back then what Smith Street looked like, and it was a really different scene. That was kind of the beginning of Brooklyn percolating, and for all the same reasons. When I interviewed Alan back then, Alan said, you know, I'd worked with David Boulay, I'd worked in these good kitchens in Manhattan, and I wanted to open up in Manhattan because Brooklyn really wasn't, and back in the late 90s and early aughts, Brooklyn hadn't really come around yet, and kind of Smith Street was the nexus. And Alan said, I kept looking at spaces in Manhattan, look at the monthly rent, and thinking, great, I got to sell a lot of chicken to make those numbers. And this thing came along in Brooklyn, and the rent, it was like $1,500 a month for that, for the bigger space, because it was, as I recall, like a double size or something. And he said, if it failed, I'd just live in it. Like, I'd just have a great, I'd have like a beautiful studio apartment with an amazing kitchen on Smith Street. That was like, that was his logic for going in there. Obviously, he did well enough, and Smith Street became kind of a destination. And now you guys are there. But to describe it to people listening, I first met you guys when I was with Jordana Rothman. We were filming at Shelsky's, which was down the street from you. Mm-hmm. And she said, I want to introduce you to these two guys. We took a break from filming. I walked down the street. She knocked on the door. We popped in. And I this narrow, how many feet wide is that space?
I'm not sure exactly, but it's probably not much more than 15 feet wide.
I was going to, top of my head, I'd say 15, 16 feet from wall to wall. There's five or six tables proper that seat maybe 15, 18 people. A lot of seating's at the bar. It's basically a long bar room with a kitchen that's open in the back that is absolutely minuscule. Yeah. Describe the kitchen again. Like, what do you have, six burners and a stove?
Yeah, we have one six-burner stove with an oven attached to it, and that's the only firepower we have in the kitchen. And the space is actually, I think we measured it, it was like 6 by 10.
It's a bar.
Like, footprint of the space.
It's a kitchen stuck in the corner of a bar, without any exaggeration. Yeah. And out of this, you do all your mise en place, all your own breads in-house, all your own pastry. I mean, it's nuts what you guys pull off out of that space.
Yeah, it's ridiculous how small that restaurant is. When people come there for the first time, they can't help but say, this is it. Like, you got to be kidding me. Like, this is all you have. But it's a pretty cool operation because we're doing a lot in a really small space,
which is kind of not on New York. I mean, that's, I remember the first time Joey Campanella, I used to live on it on Abington Square, and Joey opened Dell'Anima, which is around the corner from me, and like, what is this place? I mean, it was busy all the time from the get-go, and he came out in the street one day, introduced himself, he went in to show me the space. And it's an open, you ever been to Dell'Anima?
Yeah.
It's like open dining room with an exposed kitchen in the back. Kind of just like yours, but only theirs you actually eat facing the line cooks. Mm-hmm. So they're doing mise en place on that bar until the doors open at 5:30. There's fish being butchered, stuff being julienned. Then they have to turn that kitchen over, and it's three cooks working in a space that's pretty much the same size you have. I just remember thinking it was insane. And I remember eating at that bar one summer day and noticing that like all the cooks' legs had burn marks from the oven door would be open and somebody would turn around and their calf would hit the oven, and I'm thinking, good God. I mean, this is the business, huh? So how many years ago did you open Battersby?
Battersby's a little over 3 years old.
Talk about the beginning, and what you pick it up. I mean, because opening a restaurant's so perilous. I mean, I did it myself, and it's this great leap of faith. I mean, you know you've got the chops, you've got a concept, you have a menu, you've got all the permits, and now it's day one. You got a phone number that's ringing. Now what? How do you get people to come in? What's going to happen?
It was pretty chill in the beginning. We didn't do a lot of business, but just because the rent was low and we were doing a lot of the work, we only had one other person with us, we were pretty confident that we could sustain, you know, whatever, because I don't even think we were really paying ourselves at the time, so we just, you know.
We didn't have the money to.
It wasn't really that stressful because it was better than, I think, what we were doing before, and, you know, we didn't need to do a lot to survive. And then you know, people just started to come in slowly, and we would, you know, do our best and, you know, try to keep improving, improve the service, improve the food, you know, and then people started coming more frequently, and then we got picked up by some media, and, you know, we got a pretty big shout out in the Bon Appetit, their best 10 best thing that kind of came out of nowhere. We weren't expecting it.
And this was 10 best in the country?
10 best in the country, and I think we were three.
And this is, and just as, again, kudos to you guys, because this is really kind of great old school, the way I love stuff. No public relations behind you. No. So this isn't Bullfrog and Bomb. This isn't, you know, this isn't the usual suspect of Balt going out and pulling all the levers and bringing people in for comp meals and let's get it going. You guys did this organically. Like, it's just you with your bank account. You're not cutting payroll checks. You're paying your vendors. You're paying the rent. You're paying your taxes. And hoping at the end of the month you can shake a bag and get something out of it for yourselves.
Yeah, I mean, the primary, like, focus financially was to pay back the investors. So, you know, we just, you know, we had to keep the doors open and make back the money we borrowed, basically.
6 days a week?
We started doing six, and then we went down to five, and then we came back to seven, basically. We always wanted to be open 7 days a week, but the... it just really wasn't doable in the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, you'd kill yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, when we had our seasonal restaurant in Cape May, we would open it up in May, 5 days a week then. But then by the middle of June, we were 7 days a week through July and August in the heat, in the summer, every day, 7 in the morning till midnight. And it's just, I mean, you do it because that's what we do for a living.
That's what you gotta do.
It sucks. It's like coal mining. So you opened in the fall, right? In the fall of?
2011.
Yeah.
October. The winter, you were on. You were busy.
Yeah, kind of coming out of the winter, it started to, I mean, we definitely had some slow nights, but definitely, I mean, I think if you, you know, do a good job and you, people are impressed and then they tell more people and, you know, definitely in New York, there's a big, you know, people want to discover something.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
you know, like, once there was that, like, oh, well, you know, this place is kind of interesting or unique and it's so small and they're working there all the time. And, you know, but and all the staff we had were really good, too. And
front of the house.
Yeah, the front of the house. They were all professional. They'd all worked in good places.
Which I have to say, that is one of the distinctions. Like, one of the things that drives me nuts about Brooklyn, the scene, which is all over the place. I mean, no one can deny what it is, the vibrancy of it. The energy here is phenomenal, but the front of the house is it's just like an afterthought in a lot of the places.
Yeah, I agree.
It's your generation. I mean, it's like, okay, I just see it as like a teenage restaurant scene that when they grow up, you know, 5 years from now, they're going to realize it's called the hospitality business for a reason, that you actually, a front of the house that supports the kitchen, that does a good job welcoming and tending to the customers is the one of the essentials to the restaurant business. It has been since day one. But it's lacking in so much of Brooklyn, it just makes me crazy.
Yeah, well, we really wanted to focus on that and just, you know, we wanted our guests to have a good experience and not to feel like, you know, the worst thing is like you like, oh, you're doing them a favor by going to eat at a restaurant. It's like, what's that all about? So
that's a lot of what's happening over here. I mean, that's, you described it well. So fast forward. So the place does great. Does really well. You kind of outgrow it. There's to the point now where it's a non-reservation policy. Often the line starts to queue up at 5:15. You open at 5:30. Mm-hmm. People wait to sit. I mean, that's great. So you kind of outgrow it. You hear about another space, which becomes Dover. And now Dover's what, year one and a half?
Yeah, just a not over a year. Yeah, not a half yet, but over a year.
Way bigger space, outdoor seating. You have outdoor behind Battersby, but outdoor next to Dover. Really nice kitchen, really nice prep area downstairs. Very similar menu.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of, it's interesting. Like, when you get bigger, it's almost, you get extra resources, but it's also difficult to execute the same level. There's more hands touching stuff. There's more, you know, there's more going on. But I think we just really wanted to expand and do something else. And I mean, like, Battersby's great, and we, you know, we worked there a lot, and you know, we just wanted to kind of do something, you know, with a little bit less limitations. And we felt that the area could support it. So
we
went for it.
You're doing great at both locations. I want to hone in on the food. You do everything from scratch, everything, which is really, I mean, there's places that do a lot, but you're doing all your own bread, you're curing your own meat, you're doing your own charcuterie, obviously all your pastries done in the house if you're doing bread. The bread service is fantastic at both places. But I think one of the things, when Andrew and I had that ginormous meal the first night at Battersby, which I believe
when I went at Dover.
At Dover, excuse me, at Dover. When I went home, staggered home that night, I just remember like going to the computer and like looking at the menu, because I wanted to kind of, what did I eat? And it was like the entire menu. I believe we ate the entire menu from top to bottom. Halfway through the meal, the waitress came, and I remember saying to her, "So this is like the end, right?" And she goes, "Oh no, 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 no." Andrew, help me here. But I remember the food. My takeaway was these guys. There's no disguising chops, and you guys have them. The technique was so grounded, and in a very complimentary way, it was very sort of somewhat modernized, but not bastardized. But it was classical French cuisine right out of the Ducasse playbook, done in Brooklyn. So let's talk about a couple of the dishes. Let's break them down. Everybody has a roast chicken. Roast chicken's had its moment. I mean, we talk about the one at 11 Madison, the one they're doing at Bettany. And it's what's more satisfying and what's more fun than great roast chicken. Talk about your roast chicken, because it's such a great dish and it's so complicated. Either of you pick that one up.
Well, the chicken that we do at Dover, it's a chicken for two, and we use a Bobo chicken, which is, it's become a little bit more common right now, but it's just like,
I buy them all the time. I don't know what they are. They're just really nice and fresh. I don't know what they are. They're called Bobo chickens. I buy them with the heads are in the body, the feet are still on them.
Yeah, well, it's just a great product.
Great product.
They're very fresh, but the chicken, we remove the legs and then confit them in duck fat. So it's like, you know, a slow cooking process for two to three hours. After the meat's cooked, we shred it and then reserve it, and we make a little like warm chicken salad out of that. Like, the chicken for two is something that's been on a menu at a lot of restaurants, and you know, you see it all over the place. And one of the things that, you know, is like a little pet peeve of mine is that it takes so long to cook, and the diner's just like sitting there waiting. Like, so we wanted to, and what's really common is you show the breast, and then you do the legs as like a second service. So we wanted to find a way that ahead of time we could do the legs as the first service. So you have something to eat while we're, you know, carving your chicken and plating it up, and it's not like a whole silly theatrical process. So the legs, after they're confit and shredded apart, we make a little aioli. And basically just make this like really nice, classical, traditional chicken salad, but with black truffles. And it's kind of luxurious and, you know, like rich and unctuous. And we top it with these different shaved vegetables, celery root, apple, and fresh shaved black truffles. And that's your first service. The second service is the breast, but we roast that whole on the cage of the chicken, or what's what's called the crown. That's when you remove the legs,
right.
And it's just left on the backbone, and it kind of gives it, you know, support and structure while it's cooking. And it's, you know, cooked slow in the oven at a low temperature with a lot of butter, garlic, and thyme. Basted, cared for, very carefully cooked.
Butter basted, there's thyme in the pan, you're checking it out, you're turning, getting a gorgeous color on that thing.
Yeah. And, you know, just cooked in a very traditional way, but very carefully executed. And, you know, we just serve that in second service with some grilled radicchio that's been cooked with a little bit of balsamic vinegar and sherry vinegar. And then we also prepare on the side winter vegetable gratin, which is, you know, like five different types of winter vegetables, like rutabaga, turnip, butternut squash, celery root, which is cooked in a black truffle cream with Comté cheese. And that's served as a little side dish for the chicken.
But you're obviously you make this, you're familiar with it, so it's like ho-hum, but I'm thinking about this. I saw it done, and I don't think it's so much mise en place. It's one dish, and there's so many components to it, so many moving parts. I mean, it's just, I mean, kudos to you guys, because it is one of those great dishes where it almost exceeds the sum of the parts, and there's a lot of parts that are added up to that.
Yeah, there's a lot going on, and you know, it's not a lot of people are it's a very ordinary and traditional way to cook, but not a lot of people are cooking that way. And I think that's, you know, something that is very specific about what we do at Dover. It's like, you know, like these high-end classical techniques that are executed in a very modern, approachable way. And it's made fresh in the execution that, you know, that we do there. And you know, it's not like pre-cooked or like sitting in a, you know, cryovac bag for a couple of days before we serve it. It's, you know, there's an experienced cook watching it, caring for it, like treating it as if it was like he's cooking for his family or something. And at the end of the day, it's just an amazing product. And $65
for two, so it's, I mean, do the math, right? So $32.50 a person. It's great. Wineless is great, by the way. Great beverage program at both places. I forget who was in charge of that, but I'm really kind of a wine, not a geeky guy, but I love wine. Drink wine all the time. Love approachable wine lists that are meshed well with the menus. So you've got that going on. I didn't have it at your restaurant, but you at Dover when we were filming, you had this beautiful. I mean, foie gras is something that. At some point, you almost fatigue of it, because I remember when Ariane Degan first opened. I remember when D'Artagnan first, that was like the first time in New York that we were getting fresh foie that was domestic, that was great. And I've been playing with it ever since, so we're going back to the 80s. And after a while, you between sautéed, whole roasted, lobes, terrines, torchon. I mean, I've had it so many ways that at some point it's like, whatever, you know, it's great, but... But then I saw this out of the corner of my eye. I'm looking at this little terrine you have. Talk about that foie gras. I didn't have it, but describe it to me, because I just, again, this goes back to the sort of the Ducasse chops and the work that's involved.
Yeah. It's just a really cool little foie gras terrine that we do. It's just an insane amount of work goes into preparing it. It's kind of ridiculous. Like, if you saw what it actually takes to make this, you would just laugh, because it's kind of ridiculous. But that's precisely what we do. We're just... You know, we want to do stuff that just, you take it that far to the edge where it's kind of like, wow, it's impressive the amount of care you put into making it. It's just a layered terrine of basically confit of foie gras, which is whole lobes of foie gras that were cured overnight with a little bit of salt and sugar, and then poached in duck fat at a really low temperature for about an hour. And then they're deveined and then pressed into a roll or a torchon, and then allow it to cure like that for some time.
In salt?
No, just...
By itself?
Yeah, just by itself. Okay. And then, you know, as it...
It's cooked already.
It's cooked already, right. But you let it go a couple of days. The flavor develops and it matures. And then depending on, you know, the fruit that's available or whatever you want to use that particular day, I think at the time we were doing with pears. So we made like a little... chutney of pears, and then also like a clear pear aspic, right. Or jelly, and basically make a very beautiful layered foie gras terrine, where there's one layer of foie gras and then one layer of the, the pear compote, another layer of foie gras, and another layer of the clear jelly, and it's just pressed and then set into this like thin rectangular cake form, and then it's sliced, so you get this like almost looks like a dessert. It's like a beautiful candy bar slice, layered and shiny.
Shit ton of work. And why don't we go on further? I'll talk about the book in a second. But you also do pig's feet, which is something everybody loves. Chefs love it. They're gelatinous. They're great. But sometimes in France, you order them and they're on the bone. And it's like, oh, really, dude? You know, it's like, I'm a lazy guy. If I eat crabs, I mean, there's people that love cracking crabs and picking the meat out, or the people like me that love buying jumbo lump or back thin. But you have those beautiful little croquettes or whatever you want to call them of pig feet, which is just was a beautiful dish too. Celeriac remoulade, what'd you serve that with?
That's raw celery with, you know, cornichons and capers and mustard, and we did black truffles in there too. The pig, we get whole pigs or half pigs a lot, and you know, we just utilize everything. And you know, it's fun for us, and it's fun for the cooks that work with us to, you know, get to do different things, not just do the same thing all the time. Not, you know, some places they only buy like one cut of meat, and yeah, it's kind of
right. If I see one robotic, more brined, yeah, center cut, bone in pork chop, yeah, I mean, okay, great, but
so yeah, so you know, we'll get the heads or the feet or both, and simmer them in an aromatic stock for a really long time till they're falling apart, and kind of shred them up and make season the mixture and roll it up or press it so it forms a shape, and then we can bread it and deep fry it. Sometimes we just slice it thin and just warm it under the salamander and then kind of spread it on bread or something.
It was great. I mean, the only one I had that held a candle to it was the one at Minetta, which is a killer. If you haven't had that yet, it's right there. Talk about the book, and Andrew, you can chime in here. You've got a book coming out. When's the book coming? Soon?
October.
Okay, so we'll get ahead of it. We'll have you back when the book comes out, obviously. But talk about the concept of the book, because it's a great, great, great concept.
Go for it.
Andrew, go.
The concept of the book was something that grew organically out of Battersby and that small kitchen you were just talking about. It was an idea that actually was in place when I happened on the scene. Joe and Walker and I happen to have the same agent. And the idea was that because they operate in such, a small space, such a place that really doesn't have much more than the burners and the oven, but they're able to produce this amazing food. You know, a lot of times when chefs do a book, you have to figure out how to bridge what they do with what home cooks do. That was sort of that was a layup with this book, because they're already in a lot of ways, you know, BTUs aside, they are operating very much out of a space not unlike what most people have at home, right? And with not a lot of expensive extra equipment and gadgets and all this kind of stuff. It really is about flavors, techniques, thoughtful compositions. There's some beautiful photography in the book, but a lot of the dishes don't require a lot of sort of visual, you know, plating finesse. So that's what the concept is. The subtitle of the book is, the book is called Battersby, Extraordinary Food from an Ordinary Kitchen. Simple. And that's what we've done. It's got about 100 recipes. Almost every one of them is actually from the restaurant. There's a couple of cameos from dishes from Dover, which opened as we were writing the book. So the caviar pie, which is terrific, and the chicken for two that Joe was just describing at length, those are all in the book.
And this is your 20th book?
It's like not saying your age. I'm not going to say how many books, but I'm well past 20.
Yeah, so I mean, you've been at this forever. So I mean, I'm really looking forward to this. Your first was Alfred Portavi's Gotham book back in the 90s.
The first Gotham Bar Girl cookbook, yeah, right. 98, I think, was published.
So you've been collaborating with chefs as an author to sort of bridge that. So it's something that, for you, you're great at. And this is, I think, a great book because, A, you've got a great point of view. You've got great experience with this, clearly, and a track record. But then, I mean, in the interest of full disclosure, my kitchen in my apartment in Manhattan is bigger than your kitchen at Battersby. I mean, you're... You, I don't, It's, that is like in the hourglass of kitchens. That is about as tiny as you can get. And it's going to be a great book because obviously you're doing really three-star food out of that tiny kitchen. And this kind of makes how that kind of cooking accessible to the public through what you're doing.
Yeah, that's one of the great things about the book. Like I said, Battersby, we're doing a lot in a really small space. And, you know, the book and working with Andrew, he's done a really good job about breaking down the recipes in a way that is exactly like how we cook for a restaurant service. And probably how you want to cook is if you're having guests over for dinner. There's like a preparation stage, right, and like where you can take things to without really, you know, going too far, and then putting it on hold until you're absolutely ready to serve, and then trying to keep that minimal so you can spend more free time with your guests.
Yeah, so each recipe is literally broken down to prep, and then after that, right, to serve.
Which is really smart, because A, I think a lot of the public's intimidated to cook. I mean, you and I grew up, it's like a second language, right? We look at food and kind of intuit what it can be. No big deal. Most home cooks don't have that ability. And then the other thing is the timing. Like, you know, you've been doing mise en place all your life in service, so we kind of get the idea, oh, yeah, I can do this ahead of time. I can cook this ahead of time. I can hold this warm. It's not going to suffer. And for home cooks, I think that's like the nightmares. They invite people over. It's a big deal. And they crumble under the weight of cooking for five guests because there's a way to do it. So great, great, great book coming out. I can't wait to see that thing. Guys, thanks for coming in. I'll let you get back. You were the first guest today. You've got two restaurants to run. Dover and Battersby. If you're living around Manhattan and Brooklyn and or anywhere in the New York metro and you haven't been to these restaurants, they're both in Carroll Gardens. F Train. I mean, I was embarrassed. I still am at how close you guys are to me. My F Train stops Delancey, Essex. It takes me 10 minutes to get to where you are. It takes me that same time to get to 14th Street on the F Train. So you're a hop, skip, and a jump from lower Manhattan. Anybody can get on the F Train. Great, great restaurant. So worth the trip. Really, some of my best meals I had last year. Keep up the great work. Dover, Battersby, Walker, and Joe, thanks, guys.
Thank you.
I'm going to take a quick break and give a moment for the people that make this show possible and this network possible. And I'll be back with Andrew Freeman talking about what he does at Tokeland and an upcoming book he's working on. It's going to be great. Thanks. Stay tuned. So if you want to make a great tomato sauce, where do you start? You start with great canned tomatoes. And what are the best? What's the gold standard? What do the best Italian restaurants use, you think? San Marzano tomatoes from southern Italy. You know, I've heard of San Marzano tomatoes, loved them, heard the whole legend thing, knew they were delicious, but I wanted to go visit the region. So sometime back, I don't know, 06, 07, we went to San Marzano in the middle of the packing season in August. They've got a really long growing season. Starts early spring, April, May, and runs all the way through October because the weather down there is beautiful. You're along the coastline of Naples there in the shadows of Mount Vesuvius, and these are really small family farms, really small, like a half an acre apiece, and that's how they make a living, is harvesting these tomatoes. But what makes them great is the typicity of everything, the style of the tomato. It's kind of a long tomato with a really thin skin, super fleshy, super sweet tasting off the vine. We can Cento San Marzano tomatoes in the prime of the season, which is August. They just slow production down, hand pick everything. Those little basil leaves, yeah, they're all put in there by hand as well. It is the best canned tomato I've ever had, and you're going to love them too. There's a reason chefs love these things. They're San Marzano authorized from the beginning. The factory gets inspected every year. Hey, you want to make great tomato sauce at home? Start with great tomatoes. Cento San Marzano. That's what I use. Hey folks, Mike Calameco here. Years back when I had my own restaurant, I had to figure out what kind of oils to use, you know, try to make money in the restaurant business. So, you know, the most expensive oil wasn't the choice, but I had to use an oil that was great, an oil that I would use at home and also for my customers. Came upon Colavita olive oil, which to this day still stands head and shoulders above everybody in that extra virgin category in the supermarket shelves. So much of the extra virgin category is dominated by labels that sound like they're Italian. You know, they end with an O or something like that. But the truth is they're tank farm blends that come out of Italy. But what's in the jar or the can is oils from all over the world that are just spot on price. It's commodity oils. Colavita is the only one that's an extra virgin that's 100% Italian origin traceable. It's a great company. They really built their brand on the U.S. market. They get the U.S. market. So if you're looking for a super extra virgin olive oil, use the one that I've been using for years on my table at home and in my restaurants, wherever I was hanging my chef's toque. And that would be Colavita Extra Virgin. True Italian, great oil. So my first trip to Portugal was 2013. It was a wine trip. A bunch of us flew over and toured the country top to bottom. Fell in love with the place. The food, the wine, the scenery, everything. Had to come back, which I did in 14 to film. And this time, 8 days in country, top to bottom again. Food, wine, surfing, what's not to love? If you've never been to Portugal, it's an extraordinary place. Buffered on one side by the Atlantic Ocean, you've got great seafood, great wines growing in all those regions. You go a little inland, you've got more great food, incredible wine country. Of course, Port is the birthplace of ports up the Douro. But my takeaway was, I thought I'd had a lot of varietals. Like, I keep a list of 130, 135 varietals I've had over my life. Portugal has 250 of its own indigenous wine varietals. And they're killer good. A lot of them are growing there for centuries. It has some of the oldest viticulture in Europe. The sparkling wines from the Bijada, the great reds coming down south from those regions. What's not to love? Crisp whites, beautiful full-bodied reds, port wine, sparkling wine. So if you're not familiar with the wines of Portugal, next time you stop by at your local wine store, ask about them. I love them. I'm drinking a lot of them these days, and I think you will too.
Hi, I'm Reggie Watts, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Where do we get all these radio guys like Reggie Watts with that radio voice? You just have that on my show. Everyone that comes on, yeah, everyone that comes on before me that has a, hey, my name is Michael Lameco, and thanks for listening to the Heritage Radio Network. We still have Walker and Joe in here. I wanted to do a shout out. So this show's live. It's Thursday. It's, I don't know what the date is. It's January something.
January 15th.
Thank you. January 15th. Next Monday, if you happen to be in New York, it's a holiday. It's Martin Luther King's birthday. It's a holiday Monday. A lot of people are off. You guys tell me what you're doing, because you're doing some kind of really, really cool olive oil dinner at Dover. Talk to me about it.
Yeah, so we're hosting a dinner for Casa Caponeri. It's an olive oil producer in Tuscany. And the olive oil maker himself is going to be at the restaurant, and we're preparing a 5-course menu. We're going to include his olive oil in each of the courses, including the dessert. It also includes a beverage pairing and the tax and tip, $120. You can book for the tickets online at our website at doverbrooklyn.com. It's going to be a really fun event, and honestly, it's probably one of the best olive oils I've ever tasted.
Super oils in Tuscany. And we'll also, I mean, they're coming off of the worst year. I was with a bunch of olive oil producers tasting the 2014 crop about a month ago. I did an industry tasting at Whole Foods, just closed for the public, just industry. And I had producers from Spain, from Italy, from the south of France. Everybody. I mean, Italy and Spain, it's been the worst year in recorded memory. But the oils that they have, I mean, are stunning, but the production numbers are down so far, it's crazy.
Yeah, they had a really hard time this past year because of the weather, and everybody did.
Yep.
But, you know, a portion of the proceeds from the dinner is going directly to their calls, and they do a really amazing job with their production, and it's, you know, it's also a learning center, and they have internships, and it's a great place to, you know, check out.
So next Monday night, website is Battersby, Dover.com. I'll shut up. You talk.
Doverbrooklyn.com. It's this coming Monday. Okay. It's a holiday, so.
So, folks, if you're thinking about it, great. Two excuses. A, the food's great. If this will be your first time there, it's a great reason to go there. Love these guys. Love the food they're doing. It's a great cause. Go to Dover next Monday and try it out. Thank you, boys. Now get back to the stoves
yes,
here.
Yes, thank you.
Grab a piece of pie. Thanks for coming in. Amen. All right, Andrew Friedman's still with us here. He's been quiet. You heard him a little bit in that segment. Andrew's been on the show before, 20-plus cookbooks under his belt at this point. Great, great, great guy. Andrew, talk about, because we didn't talk much about it before, talk about Tokeland.
Well, Tokeland,
this is probably the easiest way for people that are listening out there. Take care, guys. Probably the easiest way for people out there in listening land that aren't familiar.
Yeah.
Just Google this up and say, who is this guy? And what a great way to meet you than
thank you.
That site.
So my site is Tokeland, and I always emphasize it's Toke, T-O-Q-U-E, L-A-N-D. Toke, of course, being the white old-fashioned white chef's hat that we all think of when we think
100
of that.
Folds, theoretically,
exactly.
For the 100 ways to cook an egg.
Exactly.
Leave it to the French.
And basically what Tokeland is, I've been doing it in earnest for, I would say this begins my third year this week, actually.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And it's about, in short, it's about sort of, you know, collaborating with a lot of chefs and having become friends with a lot of chefs, because I don't work in kitchens, but I write books with these people and about these people. They're basically my coworkers, and they become my friends. And it occurred to me at one point that I have, a lot of access, insight into a world that, a lot of people who are interested in what guys like you do, maybe don't have and would be interested in. And I told this story a couple of years ago on Michael Harlan Turkell's show, but I had a night one night I had gone to dinner at Veritas when Sam Hazen had taken over, and he and I was with Gavin Kazin, who recently left New York, and
Daniel Boulud's the chef for many, many years.
Yeah, he was the chef at Cafe Boulud,
right.
And Gavin and I were having dinner, and he and Sam had never met, and they were talking about mangalista pork and how much it costs and what do you do with the fat that you trim, and
which is pretty much all of that animal
all this
is.
Stuff, yeah. You know, and I thought. I just had this moment. I thought, you know what? I hear this kind of stuff all the time, but most people don't. So what if I wrote about that? So I started the site, and I just kind of do what I feel like, whatever grabs me. I mean, it's a labor of love. I don't have advertisers. As I say, it costs me more than it makes me, which is nothing. But it's kind of an outlet for just stuff I'd like to do. I came directly into books as a writer. I never worked at a magazine. I never worked at a website. I know a lot of those people now, and I don't say this with any bitterness or acrimony or anything like that, but I was never part of that club. You know, I didn't get magazine assignments. I still don't, to be honest. I mean, I make my living writing as an author of books. But there's things I wanted to write that were articles or, you know, someone I'd really love to interview. I just came now from a follow-up interview. I did the first part right before Christmas, and I just saw him for another 90 minutes today. And tomorrow or Tuesday, it'll be up on my site. But I just did a huge interview with Wiley Dufresne, you know, because they were getting ready to close WD-50.
Yep.
And I thought, you know what? This is a great time to – I know him a little bit. We don't know each other well, but I've known him for 10 years. And I knew him enough to reach out and say, hey, what do you think? And I thought it was a really kind of important time to do a deep dive with him. That's what the site's about.
If you go there now, if you go there today, tomorrow, you've got David Kinch, a great interview you did with him that's relatively recent, right?
Last year, before the fire.
Before the fire.
Yeah.
But it's up. I've read it a couple of times. I worked with David. He doesn't have it on his resume, but he was at the Maurice for a while when I was there with Delouvrier. You've done something with Anthony Bourdain recently.
Big interview with Tony last year.
Bouvet.
Interview with Jody Williams. I had a piece about... I did a piece in November about Gabriel Hamilton's cookbook, which was just kind of my love letter to that book, which I thought was brilliant. I kind of describe why I think it's the book that every chef would really like to write, but most publishers won't let them. I actually did a piece. I went to the opening of Gavin Kazin's restaurant in Minneapolis.
I saw that. Danielle Boulud was there.
And Danielle and Keller were there, and I did a piece about that evening. It's really sort of whatever strikes my fancy or whoever I might run into. You know, if I run into someone and they're talkative and I have my tape recorder, just turn it on and do, you know, and check in with them. And occasionally just thoughts about your industry and about individual people in it. I also do, every month or so, I do a tie-in with Eater. I do an interview series on there called Kitchen Time Machine where I interview this came about because of the book I'm working on. But I'll interview sort of an iconic New York figure from the restaurant world. And then usually, but not always, I'll write a sort of a sister post on my site. And that's something that just started in the last year.
And I think you hit the nail on the head. That's exactly how I would have described it is, I mean, without crapping on so much of what's out there, A, in the cookbook world, which whatever, it's like an industry in unto itself, the world of culinary print, which can be cliquish and funny and very tribal if you're a Bon App person or a Food and Wine person or a blogger, an eater. I mean, it's very funny and very territorial. But I think access is the word. So you're a guy that's made a living for the last 20 years by partnering with chefs, eating out, kind of becoming their friends and partners in a way, presenting their craft through books. And in the process of doing that, hanging out, spending so much time in kitchens with them that you're just kind of absorbing it all. And this is a way of giving that back versus a lot of blogs where it's just, oh, guess where I went out to? It's almost like someone's Instagram account with some bad writing underneath it. Guess what I made today? Here's my chocolate chip cookie recipe. I mean, I think it was Bourdain once said he'd rather be a serial masturbator than a blogger. I believe he said that, which is very Tony Bourdain.
I'm extra grateful he gave me an interview. I've never heard that quote.
Yours is really an exception to that. It's really kind of like it's. I'd say it's a great place for chefs to go read because it's really well thought out, well written, and it's not just like pom poms and rah rah. It's like, hey, here's where I interviewed. Let's board down questions and answers. Obviously, you tape stuff. That's how you do it.
Well, when I do an interview, it is. Yeah. But you know, most I think I don't have scientific data for this, but I think most people who read the site are either chefs, cooks, culinary students, caterers. I mean, I think people who write about the trade. I didn't really set out to be different from anything else, but I kind of stumbled into collaborating. I don't usually test recipes. A lot of people come to food writing from cooking. And I came to it from wanting to be a writer. And it's just what I thought I had. I've done so many. For example, every cookbook has an intro in the first person. So I've done so many of these deep dive interviews where I had to write somebody's, ghostwrite for them, these first person bios. The thing I always say about the site, the point of distinction to me is it's not a food site. It's a chef site.
Yeah, it's true.
You know, that's what it is. There's no recipes on the site. Very rarely is there a food photograph on my website.
I don't remember seeing any.
Yeah, it's really trying to give people a look into the business and also to try to get to some kind of understanding of certain people in the business and their feelings about the industry now and in the past. That's really what
it is. It's funny. And in a way, there's great parallels to what I do for PBS because I never wanted to do a cooking show. There's enough of them. It's like, who needs another Mike's way of making lasagna? So when I started the show 14 years ago, it was I had access to kitchens. I was an ex-chef. I was a chef.
Right.
I could call up pretty much anybody I wanted and get cameras in that kitchen, places that hadn't had cameras before, like Thomas Keller, like Danielle back in 00, 01, 02, Ducasse, you name it. And my idea was to become a lens. The show is a lens for people to see a back-of-the-house viewpoint that they'd never seen before. And if I'm good, I don't get in the way of telling the stories. Let the chefs tell their own stories.
Yeah.
What you do. It's kind of almost the same thing in a way.
Yeah, and again, sometimes things will just occur. You know, I did a thing with Walker and Joe when we were working on the book. I was spending all this time with them, and I did a thing called The Trail. And
I saw that.
It was a day in the life of the kitchen. I was there from when they changed the menu in the morning and divvied up the work and, you know, and I was there from when they walked in the door in the morning to when we all went and had drinks at Brooklyn Social after. I mean, it was the day, you know, and you know, not the most original thing, but it was just kind of sitting there to be done. I was there anyway.
And there were small restaurants. The menu got adjusted by what they had left over, what
correct.
We're going to make.
All that stuff.
We're not ordering new stuff. So, okay, let's do the inventory. That'll drive the menu. Once we have the menu driven, let's figure out some stuff that we could do that are kind of room temperature things. It was a great little piece. I mean,
thank you.
For people that don't get what the restaurant business is like. And I like these guys because these guys this isn't corporate restaurant. This isn't a restaurant that's got a million moving parts. This is really mom and stuff what they're doing.
Right.
It very much is. And then they're the mom and pop. Yeah. They are in there. They're on the line. They're doing everything. They're unlocking the place in the morning, closing the doors at night. They're all day long. That's old school. Talking about old school, you got a couple of books coming out next year. One of them is going to be the Battersby book.
Correct.
And another one soon on its heels will be this new one about kind of the 70s and 80s in the kitchens. Talk about where that idea came from and what it's going to read like.
So I'm working on a book that'll be published by Dan Halpern's company, which is Echo Press, which is part of HarperCollins. And it is basically the story, as I like to say, it's the story of the evolution of this being or this species we call the American cook and the American chef. You know, a lot of people don't realize this, but prior to the 1970s, it was really one really didn't make a decision to become a cook in this country. If you were a professional, if you grew up if you were an American and you were in a kitchen, you probably had made a wrong turn somewhere in your life. You know, Mario Batali has this great line that cooking was something you did. It was the first thing you did after the Army and the last thing you did before you went to prison. You know, that was kind of how it was known. And, you know, in the course of 20 years, we got from that to the foundation of the television network in 1993, the launch of the network, which largely was chef-based. I mean, more so in later years, but largely in the beginning. And there was also during those years, you know, the development of a chef nation, a community of chefs in this country, a path for people who wanted to become chefs that guys of your generation had to sort of figure out. And then, you know, the development of sort of this canon of American or new American classics, restaurant classics, which again did not, you know, in the up until the late 70s, a serious meal in this country was a French meal.
Yeah, no, period. Right?
That
period.
Was it.
Yeah.
American food, if it was anything, was either sort of diner food or, you know, mashed potatoes and roast chicken and meatloaf or this sort of underappreciated stuff that, you know, James Beard wrote about.
Correct.
And which Larry Forgione sort of popularized,
right,
at River,
right,
Cafe, regional,
right,
American food.
Right.
But there wasn't really a knowledge of it, you know, nationally.
There weren't serious American chefs of note back then. I mean, if you, yeah, go from Jean Blanchet in Chicago, George Perrier in Philadelphia, the handful of Fezzeguet, Saltner, Sayak,
sure,
in New York. I mean, this was it. I mean, that was American cooking was... Fine dining in America was being led by a generation of expat Europeans,
right,
mostly French,
yes,
who were cooking their food.
Yeah.
Done.
So this book is the story of, A, how and why did people, young Americans, start gravitating to this world? And an important piece of the whole story is, you know, there wasn't... Obviously, there was no internet at that time.
Yeah.
There was not a lot of coverage of this phenomenon. But, you know, the thing that always pops into my mind for anyone who ever saw Close Encounters of the Third Kind, mm-hmm, was, you know, Devil's Mountain, where everyone ends up at the end of that movie. Earlier in the movie, you know, you see, like, Roy Scheider starts making little models of devils. He doesn't know why. And then somewhere else in the country, there's a little kid drawing a cartoon of,
right,
it. And, you know, there was something in the air at that time, right? There was something in the water at that time. People were, and other things were changing as well. I believe the same sort of thing, the same sort of zeitgeist that led people into independent film, that changed stand-up comedy at that time, that changed popular music at that time. I think all of that affected food at that time and drove people into food, you know, as a creative pursuit, which it really wasn't thought of. You know, a lot of, it's a common thing to point out, but you could take the menus of the top French restaurants in any major city. They were the same menu.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was all the same dishes. It was,
yeah,
these classic repertoire. It wasn't considered an outlet for creativity or self-expression. That's something else that happened during this time. So that's very broadly what the book is about. But it's also about young guys. I mean, you were nice enough to give me an interview, and we talked about some of this. But, you know, on the East Coast, it was a different path than the West Coast. But to talk about the East Coast for just a minute, you know, it was, you know, a lot of people got jobs as dishwashers in high school. or junior high. They weren't,
yeah,
the best students.
Right.
There was something about the kitchen that appealed,
yeah,
to them.
Right.
They decide to go to the Culinary Institute of America. They supplement that with this, they all sort of have this intuitive idea that I got to get next to a French chef, whether that was in one of these kitchens in New York or staging in
Europe.
Well, you
did. It wasn't a foggy idea. That's what you had to do.
You had to do
it. That was the career path.
You know?
Go to
the
CIA, graduate, and then get in line, and Jean-Jacques Rachou, André Saltner, Fezzeguet, those handful of restaurants.
Right.
Keep your mouth shut, come in early, stay late, and
right,
if you got a job, you were kissing the ground they walked on, and then hopefully you could move up the line within that kitchen.
Right, but what I think is important is during those years, which actually weren't all that long ago, yeah, you know, now it's nothing for a young cook to say, I'm going to go do a stage at so-and-so.
Right.
Nobody knew what a stage was in those days. You know, I remember I interviewed Terrence Brennan, and he had written a letter to André Saltner, and Saltner wrote him back and said, you know, I don't have a position in my brigade right now, but, you know, when you're in New York, come for a cup of coffee and we'll talk. And Terrence had to look up brigade, right? Like, you guys didn't know you were the first generation to sort of create this pathway that now exists for young cooks in this country that's sort of just assumed now in common knowledge. you know. But this was all created during these years, so that's one piece of the story. And of course, you know, chefs attaining a certain level of financial success, right, and celebrity, or whatever you want to call it.
I'll tell you, when Daniel Boulud first came to the city, and he was working at the Westbury. So we're going back to the early 80s, maybe the mid 80s. Don't get me the exact date. He was making like $45,000, $50,000 a year, mm-hmm, man. That's what chefs made. And yeah, that's a 6 day a week, 12 to 13. I mean, that was it. There was no bitching, there was no moaning. That's what an executive chef made.
Yeah.
You came in here. I remember I worked 6 days a week as a line cook at the Four Seasons restaurant, Park Avenue. You know, great story, great history of that place. 6 days a week, I was taking home $186 in 1982 after taxes. Yeah. That was what it was.
Yeah.
And to your point, it was kind of hard for Americans to get into some of those French kitchens. And I can't wait to read this book because you're so good.
But, well, you and me both.
There
you
was
and me
this both. There was Jean-Jacques Rachou, who we're going to try and arrange to get together with. Jean-Jacques Rachou was really broke from the tyranny of the French mentality at the time in New York, where in the 1970s, if you were, see, it didn't matter who, you couldn't work, you couldn't get a full-time job in any of those French kitchens. They hired French guys.
Right.
They'd hire you part-time, and that was it. And Jack was the first guy to say, I really think these American kids can do it. And it caused an uproar.
Well, but the other thing that's fascinating to me is, you know, and it'll probably get your blood going because it does for a lot of people, you know, the way the labor laws have changed so dramatically. But, you know, I've had many people tell me, Charlie Palmer told me this great story where he, there was a CIA instructor named Danis.
I know the story. And he was Danis, in the E room, and a chef had a roast beef, and he was like one of the cooks.
No, not this.
Oh, not that story. Tell me something. Okay.
So
Danis was nuts. He was a mentor for Charlie.
So there was almost this underground railroad of Europeans that helped, or resistance, whatever you call it, that kind of this little network that would get American kids into a French kitchen, right? So this instructor brings Charlie Palmer, who now lords over an empire of restaurants and hotels, right? So young Charlie Palmer is brought to lunch at La Lavandou. He's thinking about Jean-Jacques Rachou's getting ready to do La Côte Basque in New York, and he's taken to lunch. Rachou is there, and Danins and Rachou and young Charlie Palmer have lunch. And at the end of the lunch, almost like a scene from The Godfather, Danins and Rachou speak in French for 10 minutes. Charlie has no idea what they're talking about. And at the end of it, Rachou turns to Charlie and says, okay, you come on March 26th. You start March 26th. Charlie has no idea what the job is, what it pays, if it pays. This is how much people, this is how desperate people were to hone their craft.
And he was
in
thrilled.
Those days.
He was thrilled.
And they were thrilled, and they came in, and they all worked,
air,
you know, 16 hours a day, 6 days a week, and that was the world.
That was the world. And I'll tell you another Denon story. So you probably didn't tell you this. E-Room back then, circa 1970-something. It's your last class at the Culinary Institute. You do front of the house and back of the house. So Denon's was lording over the kitchen, and one of the young aspiring culinary graduates is taking a roast beef out of the roasting pan with a roasting fork. He just jabs the thing and he picks it up, and Danins comes over and just smacks him on the back and says, what are you doing? You cannot stab meat like that. And the kid says, excuse me, chef, why? And Danins got the roasting fork and stabbed the kid's hand and said, because it bleeds. Yeah, those were the days. Talk about workplace rules. And I'm sure Charlie can have, I mean, we all have stories of chefs literally kicking us in the ass, throwing our knives against the wall, breaking plates, you know, just literally physically abusing you. Because remember, a lot of those French guys were kind of angry guys, too. There was booze in those kitchens, and we could go on and on about the kind of mentality that some of those guys had. They weren't the most well-adjusted people either.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that was necessarily the best system, but every to a person, people who were in it will say it made them great cooks.
Yeah, it was. I can't wait for the book. I've known a few guys that have wanted to write this book who have talked to me about it over the years, and I was like, dude, it's a great idea. No one's done it because the food's so popular now. But I think so much of the younger, you know, the millennials and the 30-some-year-olds, they don't get the history of this. There is kind of an anthropological line that you can follow in America. It happened today for a reason, and you're talking about sort of the beginning of those days.
Well, it is, but also the thing I hasten to point out, much like my blog, is that, you know, to me, the point of distinction is this is very much about the evolution of the chef community and chef culture in this country. I think there have been a number of books, a number of them very good, about the development of the evolution of the food.
Yeah.
But to me, this is very specifically about, you know, the American, not strictly American-born, because people like Wolfgang Puck and Danielle and Jean-Georges are all part of this story. And Jean-Louis Papin, these are all important players in this story.
Huge.
But it is about the evolution of this community and this culture in this country. That's what the book's about.
We'll get you back on.
Thank you.
Before the book comes out, you're a great source. Andrew Friedman's been my second guest, and he was here for the beginning as well, with the boys from Dover and Battersby. Website one more time?
Toqueland, TOQUELAND.com.
Great read. Love the way it's written. Much respect for the industry. It's great. I mean,
thank you.
It's a great, refreshing voice. He curates it well. It's beautifully written. And who do I have next week? Stay tuned. The show's over. But I think next week I've got Charlie Palmer, Mimi Sheridan, and somebody else. Going to be a good show. Some big wigs coming out to Bushwick for that one. Stay tuned. See you next week, and have a good one in between.
The song for Food Talk with Mike Colomeco is Real Long Way to Go by Brothers.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.